Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I share my fat talking points. I chat with Brian from Red Number 3 about Maggie going on a diet, and I spotlight a blog from You're Welcome. Once my radio show went on the air, I began doing media interviews for news outlets across New Zealand. Doing media is relatively new for me, and I often found that I would stumble and stutter when answering my questions. And sometimes I didn't actually make the points I wanted to make. So I decided that it would be helpful to actually develop some talking points, standard answers for common questions that I received. And I call them my fat talking points. Someone suggested that I share them on my blog, so I did. And I thought I'd go ahead and share them on the show as well. Now, so it won't be me asking myself questions that I myself answer. I've actually recruited one of my BFFs, Miss Gabrielle, to come on the show and ask me the question. Say hi, Gabrielle.
Kia ora.
Excellent. So she's going to play the role of interviewer, and I will be the role of interviewee, me, myself. And I told her to go ahead and role play this however she wants. So let's get started.
Excellent. So, Kat, what's the purpose of your show?
So the goal of the show is to change the national conversation about fatness.
Is the show glorifying obesity?
Well, Friend of Maryland is about promoting the idea that fat people deserve the same rights and dignity as non-fat people.
So you're telling me that fat people don't currently have the same rights and dignity?
No, they definitely don't. Not protected classes in most countries the way that gender, race, or ethnicity, or age, for example, are. So it's legal to discriminate an individual because they're fat. And fat people are often denied what we consider as basic human dignity. Take, for example, the representations of fat bodies that we see every day. Most of the stories about the obesity pandemic or fatness in general, they're accompanied by a picture of what Charlotte Cooper calls a headless fatty, which is a fat person from the neck down or just a fat stomach. And this is an example of objectification. And that leads to fat being people being seen as less than human. And if fat people are seen as less than human, then it's okay to discriminate and oppress them.
So why do we care about the size of other people's bodies?
It's probably a lot of different reasons, but I think a lot of it is because we believe that we can judge people's personal and moral characteristics based on their bodies. So we look at a fat body and believe that it displays to us a person who is lazy or stupid, lacking willpower, asexual, etc. But as Marilyn Wan always says, the only thing you can learn by looking at my fat body is your own level of fat prejudice.
So do you believe fat people want to lose weight?
You know, I do. I think most probably do. It's a sane choice when you live in a world that finds you disgusting. Being fat is considered unhealthy, lazy, undesirable, and oftentimes a moral failure. If we look back at other groups who have been oppressed and discriminated against, we can find members of such groups engaging in activities to negotiate or reduce that stigma. So ethnic minorities might use creams to lighten their skin or straighten their hair. Gays and lesbians may marry and raise families in heterosexual relationships. I believe that many fat people would rather not be fat and that they often try to achieve this through weight loss.
So surely if people just ate less and exercised more, they could stop being fat.
What the research demonstrates, and has, by the way, for over 50 years, is that only 5% of people who attempt to lose weight are able to maintain a significant weight loss for more than 5 years. 95% of people gain back the weight they lose, and often more, within 5 years. And this is true for people who diet and for those who make lifestyle changes as well.
So why the poor success rate for weight loss? Are people just not motivated? Is it a lack of willpower?
We honestly don't know why weight loss has such a high failure rate. Personally, I find it silly to pathologize 95% of the population and suggest that they simply lack the willpower needed to succeed. The human body is a complex organism, and while we would like to believe that it is as easy as calories in and calories out, the empirical evidence shows that it's just not that simple.
So what would you recommend instead?
Well, I believe that every person, regardless of their body size, deserves basic human rights and dignity. And I like the paradigm of health at every size, which promotes that every body, regardless of size, can engage in healthy behaviors. I am not, however, a proponent of healthism, which is the idea that people have a moral obligation to be healthy. I do believe that people, especially direct care workers, should be educated on what I call the obesity myths, because I hope that it will decrease fat phobia and hatred.
So what are these obesity myths?
The obesity myths are the assumptions about the relationships between weight and health that many people believe to be true. So, for example, a lot of people believe that permanent weight loss is possible, and so they wonder why fat people just don't try harder to become non-fat. Another obesity myth is that obesity rates are increasing, when for most industrialized countries, obesity rates leveled off about a decade ago. And yet another is that being fat is unhealthy.
So you're arguing that being fat can actually be healthy?
Absolutely. There are fat people who are healthy, and there are fat people who are not healthy, just as there are non-fat people who are healthy and non-fat people who are not healthy. Body size is not a good proxy for health, and it's dangerous for all people, both fat and not, to believe that it is.
So are you healthy?
It would depend on how you define or determine health. So if you're defining health by medical tests and levels, then yes, I'm healthy. If you're defining health by the behaviors I engage in, well, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I eat nutritious meals, get more than 6 hours of sleep a night, exercise regularly, and look both ways before crossing the street. So yes, I am healthy. But if you're defining health the way that New Zealand immigration does, for example, then no, I am not healthy simply because I have a BMI over 35. People look at my fat body and they believe it shows them that I am not healthy. They believe it tells them that I eat crap and never exercise, as though these are the only health behaviors that matter. And this is true for doctors as well, as research finds that physicians do not counsel their non-fat patients about diet and exercise. They make the assumption that they are eating healthily and exercising simply because they are not fat. And the research we have just doesn't support the assumption. If I walk into McDonald's with a non-fat friend and we both order a Big Mac, people in the store might think, why is that fat woman eating that? Or she doesn't need to eat that. And it will reinforce negative stereotypes that they have about fat people. But it is unlikely that any of them will think the same things about my non-fat friend, even though we are both consuming the same item of food that is being deemed unhealthy. Focusing on weight instead of health is dangerous.
Why is that?
It's dangerous for a lot of reasons. First, conflation of health and weight leads to confusion for both fat and non-fat people alike. So you may have a fat person who doesn't believe that what they eat matters, and why bothering anyway, exercising, because they're fat, which must be unhealthy. And you have a non-fat person who doesn't believe what they eat matters, and why bother exercising anyway, because they are not fat, so they're healthy. Also, many people engage in unhealthy behaviors to lose or maintain weight. Consider the social approval of a fat woman who severely limits her calories and obsesses about her weight. That same behavior in a non-fat woman would possibly be diagnosed as an eating disorder. So why the discrepancy? Why the double standard? Another reason it is dangerous is because it contributes to fat phobia and oppression.
Are fat phobia and oppression harmful?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Fat phobia, or fat stigma, or fat hatred, whatever you want to call it, it's harmful. It stigmatizes fat people, which is bad for both physical and mental health, and it also affects non-fat people, making many of them terrified of becoming fat. Being shamed or bullied is never good for anyone. And of course, a lot of fat phobia and hatred is actually hidden behind a cloak of concern.
A cloak of concern?
So most concern, and this is my personal belief, that the health of fat people, the concern that we have, is really just about fat prejudice. People don't care about my health. It's a way for them to express their own disgust and fear of my fat. I know they don't care about my health because they're not concerned about whether I wear a helmet when I ride my bike or speed when I drive my car. They don't care if I starve myself to lose weight or get regular exams at the doctor. This lack of caring about anything besides my weight is evidence to me that it's not my health they're concerned with. It's my fat. They find it distasteful or disgusting, or it makes them uncomfortable. But that's their problem, not mine. And those are my fat talking points. Joining me today is Brian Stewart from the blog Red Number 3. Brian, thank you so much for coming on Friend of Marilyn.
Well, thank you for having me.
I read your blog religiously, and I also follow you on Tumblr, and I have to admit that I'm quite excited and a bit geeked out, actually, by having a chance to actually talk to someone that I admire so much.
Well, thank you. I've been listening to the podcast, so I likewise.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. I'm glad to know there's at least one person out there who's listening. So the reason I thought I'd bring you on is because I have been following with avid interest your series about a little girl named Maggie. So I thought I'd bring you on, and just if you could kind of – and we can talk about that. So just to start, I appreciate there might be some people listening who don't actually know anything about Maggie going on a diet or subsequent adventures that you've done. So can you kind of introduce those listeners to what you're doing?
Sure. Well, it started a couple of months ago, I believe. There was an announcement of a new book that was going to be coming out, which had created quite a stir, not just in the fatosphere, but I think in mainstream publications as well. It was a book called Maggie Goes on a Diet, which was aimed at children, and featured a 14-year-old protagonist, Maggie, who gets bullied over her weight and decides to lose weight, at which point she becomes incredibly popular and a soccer star, and everything ends wonderfully for her. And one of the main features of it during that discussion was the cover of the book. I think the book only just recently came out, or it may be just about to come out, but when it was announced, the cover was publicized, and on the cover, there's a picture of Maggie, who has a fat girl, looking into a mirror and holding a dress, and her reflection in the mirror is her thin self holding the dress, presumably now fit her. So I think those things create kind of a touchstone that people responded very negatively to. I think,
right.
I think what people were really responding to were that image and also the word diet being specifically marketed to children, something a lot of people had a very strong negative response to. And I was certainly one of them, and I was following a lot of the discussion. And at some point, looking at this picture, I kept thinking, this is such an awful image. I'm really frustrated with this image because it's an image that kind of represents what I think a lot of fat people are told, that we're just thin people waiting to happen.
Right. We're broken thin people.
Yeah. Thin person.
Yeah, just waiting to get out. Yeah.
So I really wanted to address that and kind of say that, no, we can, our lives as fat people are good and are worth living. And so the first thing I did was I created this kind of, just a very simple adaptation of the cover where you saw the fat image of Maggie still as the original cover, but in the reflection it was, again, the same image. So it's just Maggie looking at herself and with the title, that Maggie regains the weight, which is what most people who diet do experience, and then learns to accept her body to create kind of a more positive, affirming message coming out of what was created basically as diet propaganda.
Absolutely. Well, and such a subversive message as well. I mean, I know that for us in the fatosphere, the idea of fat people actually not hating their bodies isn't new, but I think for a lot of people, just suggesting that is very subversive. It's you know, you're being a rebel, as Marilyn Wan would say.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people, and I think this is why a lot of mainstream press have responded negatively to it too, respond very poorly to the word diet. And they kind of understand that regaining weight is part of what the diet cycle is. I think there's a lot of understanding about that, but there's not a lot of understanding that when you're a fat person, that can be okay too, and you can accept yourself and you can be happy that way. And I think that's the kind of message that a lot of the mainstream press were kind of publicizing it. None of them actually wanted Maggie to be happy while she was fat.
Yeah.
They could sense that they didn't feel right about the book, but none of them really had the sense that, well, she should accept her body and she
right.
should be okay with it. And, you know, she should concentrate on all the things that she can accomplish in that body without focusing on changing it. And as I continued, that was what I started focusing on after creating the first kind of, subversive cover.
So, because your subsequent covers have been more about kind of, as you said, like Maggie not only embracing herself and her body, but then going on to being able to live a meaningful life in that fat body.
Absolutely. There was a really great response to the first cover, and a lot of people were suggesting other things that Maggie could do. And I really got a lot of inspiration out of this and started kind of looking at, well, you know, what are the other things? You know, it's not just about accepting your body. It's about, you know, kind of taking this kind of character that was created for such a negative purpose and sort of taking her back and kind of, you know, reclaiming her and repurposing her to kind of offer fat people a message of all the other things we can do, all the other possibilities that we have available to us. Yeah, I think one of them was Maggie gets a master's in gender studies. Maggie joins a roller derby league. It's not all just about loving herself, although some of them are. Maggie protests fat stigma. Maggie reclaims the word fat or other ones. But it's just all these things that are very body positive that a lot of fat people can do in their lives without losing weight and without focusing on number on a scale to be the judge of their self-worth.
Well, and it's such a powerful message, too, for a larger non-fat audience as well, just in the sense of embracing your body and living your life and doing the things that you want to be doing instead of kind of putting a pin in things and saying, oh, well, you know, I want to do this, but I want to lose 5 more pounds first, or I want to do this, but I'm not quite comfortable with the way that I look in the swimsuit or the dress or, you know, the dance costume or whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what a lot of people look at as what they can do when they're a fat person is what they will do when they're not a fat person.
Right.
And they push all of those ideas, all of those goals, all of those aspirations aside to focus on their body size. And to be shaming themselves for having a body size that is deemed unacceptable. And what I was really trying to explore with the Maggie series is that idea that you don't have to wait. You can do all of these things. There are right now fat people out there who are living their lives and finding happiness and finding joy without trying to lose weight. And that all of those things are things you can seek out, you can work towards right now. And I think that's ultimately what I hope is the real message of this and something that I think a lot of people responded very well to.
So how many titles have you done for Maggie so far?
I think it's about 12 or 13.
Oh,
I've lost a little bit of track. I've got a couple that I'm planning that I haven't done yet.
Okay.
So I think it's either 12 or 13 right now.
Well, you know, I think maybe Maggie needs to be a guest on Friend of Marilyn, perhaps. Could be a potential title. So I know that, as you said, like kind of there was a lot of discussion and outrage outside of the fatosphere about this Maggie Goes on a Diet book. And as you said, you know, people were quite rightfully horrified at this idea of promoting dieting to, you know, 6 to 8 year olds. But as you said, they weren't willing to then take it all, you know, the step further and say that she should embrace her body. So I know that there's a new book now that's coming out that has a bit different language, which I believe it's titled Eddie Shapes Up.
Yes.
How do you think that one will be received?
Marilyn wanted actually let me know about this book coming
okay.
out. It's by the former mayor of New York City, Ed Koch.
Okay.
And it was actually announced at the same time, obviously much quieter, because people didn't really respond very negatively to it. I look at it and kind of, it's to me, it strikes me as very similar to Maggie Goes on a Diet. But it kind of positions itself in a way that most people think is acceptable to promote shame among fat children.
Can you explain that a little bit just for listeners who might not understand why it's a bit more acceptable to the general public, but it's still just as problematic as the Maggie book?
Oh, absolutely. What it does is, I think, we were talking before, that I think a lot of people responded very negatively to this image, particularly of a girl, with the image of her and her thin reflection. And the word diet itself are things that I think people have a very negative association with, and with good reason. Diets don't work. But there's also a very long tradition of people calling diets something else and simply kind of adjusting the language slightly so that everybody can feel more comfortable about it.
Like a lifestyle change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what Eddie Shapes Up is doing. It gives some lip service to the idea that, well, there's lots of bodies, but, you know, the fat bodies aren't really good. And it doesn't, you know, it's trying to be affirming, but it's still delivering the core message that if you're fat, that's not okay. And that's what's problematic, but I think it's delivered in a package that a lot more people are going to respond to, unfortunately, because it just doesn't, it avoids some of the touch words and that people responded very negatively towards in Maggie Goes on a Diet, while still delivering ultimately, I think, the same message that fat children should be pressured and stigmatized for their size, and that they shouldn't be encouraged just to try to be healthy or active, but they really needs to be a focus on their body size being wrong. And the idea that you need to, you know, shape up, you know, it really isn't about, you know, being active. It's, you know, the happy ending is going to be losing weight. And they try to find ways to say this without saying it directly, but it's still very problematic in that way.
Well, I think it's interesting because I had Patty Thomas on the show last week talking about fat stigma and its effects on kids specifically. And, you know, so kind of the Maggie book and then maybe also this Eddie book, it's this interesting idea that because these fat kids are bullied for being fat, they need to be the ones to change, right? Instead of changing the culture or pointing to the bullies and say, you need to stop being bullies. And yet we don't seem to do that with other stigmatized or marginalized identities.
No, I mean, I think there are ways that happens, but I think we see this kind of awful combination of things that happen with the stigmatizing of fat children, where there's this sort of general cultural understanding, well, that's not good. But at the same time, there's also a general understanding that, well, we shouldn't really let them be fat.
Right.
And that there's this notion that if we're not stigmatizing them, then we're allowing them to be fat and unhealthy and all of the negative associations that our culture puts on fat people. So it kind of creates this odd dynamic where, you know, people understand it's really not okay to be actively shaming and bullying fat children, but at the same time, the solution they really want is, well, stop being fat children. And it creates this kind of very strong disconnect that I'm sure kids themselves understand and respond to. They're receptive to that sort of thing. They get double talk.
Right.
And they know when you're saying one thing and another, and they get that message. And unfortunately, it's a message that's very much about making them feel bad about themselves. And I think that's what kids come away with this kind of a culture and the way it talks about fatness, particularly fatness in children, that for all its concern about creating self-esteem issues, ultimately people seem to be much more focused on creating those self-esteem issues. And they just want to feel better about it by getting a little bit of lip service to the notion that, well, that's not a good thing. For as far as kind of shaming fat children, but they don't actually want to stop doing it.
Right. So what's next for Maggie in your world?
Well, I've got a few ideas coming up that I hope to do. There's so many possibilities of where you can kind of take Maggie, just because there's so many different, you know, things that fat people are doing themselves and that you can draw inspiration from. And I'm inspired by so many of the wonderful active fat activists that you see online right now and all the amazing things that they're doing. So I'm drawing a lot of inspiration from that. And, you know, it's also a lot of the simple things. One of the things I think the next one I'm going to be doing is Maggie Goes to a Beach.
Oh, nice.
Because it's one of those simple things that a lot of fat people deny themselves. And they think, well, I can't do that. I can't go to a beach. I can't have my body be seen. There's a lot of ways that fat people kind of really internalize a great deal of shame over their bodies and deny themselves these kind of social experiences that are really quite ordinary and normal and fun. So that's one of the things I'm looking forward to having Maggie do.
Well, that sounds great. And I'm so glad that you're willing to come on today to talk about the Maggie series. And hopefully if there's anyone listening who hasn't checked out the Maggie series on your blog or on your Tumblr, I hope that they will, because it really is fantastic work that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. I'm blown away by the response to it. I'm really grateful that so many people have responded so well to it and have responded with such enthusiasm and appreciation. And I'm enjoying doing it, so I hope to do some more.
Well, I hope that you'll be willing to come back on the show again in the future and give us an update, Brian.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, thanks.
Well, thank you.
spotlight today is a blog from You're Welcome. You're Welcome is a blog dedicated to breaking down social justice movements and proposing solutions. The blog that I'm spotlighting today was published on February 21st, and it's called Breaking Down Fat Phobia. Quote, "While many of us recognize how oppression and denial of oppression operates within many communities, not all of us understand how that works with fat people. As with any system designed to exclude, shame, or oppress people on the basis of shared characteristics or identities, it can be easy to assume that fat phobia only exists one-on-one, person to person. Not so. It's a series of complex interlocking systems designed to shame, silence, and correct fat people. Because discussions of fat phobia are new to many of us, we may not recognize it as a layered system of oppression. Plus, when we fail to recognize the way in which fat phobia operates, it becomes difficult to recognize that it even exists, much less how to effectively interrupt it. There are several levels of fat phobia. Among them, personal fat phobia, cultural fat phobia, and institutional fat phobia. Let's walk through what each of look like in action. Personal fat phobia. This is where the conversation begins and often where it ends. I define personal fat phobia as the ways in which fat phobia is perpetrated on a one-to-one, person-to-person basis. It's important to note that personal fat phobia doesn't need to be intentional. Regardless of what you mean by what you said or did, its impact remains the same. Some examples include policing what a fat person is eating, or telling them about their own health. Nobody knows more about diets, exercise, health, and nutrition than fatties. Friends, family members, doctors, partners, and even strangers on the street have freely suggested a million and one things that we can do to change our bodies. Many of us have tried them all. And for those of us who've decided to stop hating our bodies, policing what we eat is a harsh reminder that, within current social systems, we are prohibited from defining our own bodies. Shaming fat people for wearing unflattering clothing. See above. When I was in high school, my mother made a list of things I shouldn't wear. Cap sleeves, belts, skirts with hemlines above the knee, horizontal stripes, bright colors, drop waist, tank tops, pencil skirts. Needless to say, my mom-approved outfits look like, well, something a mom would wear. The problem is that damn near every style guide and fashion magazine agrees that I should retreat to a life of caftans, muumuus, and graduation gowns. The implication here is that telling fat people what not to wear is doing us a favor, and allowing us to define how we want to be seen would cause us grievously harm. I heartily disagree. Another example is giving unsolicited suggestions about weight loss for our health. This one's problematic on a couple of fronts. First, as witness above, a lot of fatties know a whole lot about losing weight, for real. Second, my health doesn't require weight loss. Every physical I have shows that I'm healthy as a horse. Third, my health is nobody's business. Seriously. Fourth, and perhaps most basically, the assumption underlying unsolicited weight loss suggestions is that we can all agree that my body is repulsive and abhorrent, and I must hate it and desperately want to change it. Except that I don't. Insisting that fat people are universally unattractive or publicly refusing to date us. That one's pretty basic, right? You don't have to want to date us, but you don't have to shout it from the rooftops, and you can't speak for the rest of the world. Again, personal fat phobia is a big challenge and is where a lot of internalized fat phobia comes from, but personal fat phobia isn't the whole picture, end quote. The piece goes on to present examples of both cultural and institutional fat phobia, and hopefully in a later show, I'll cover these as well. Thanks for listening to Friend of Marilyn on Access Manor 2, 999 AM. Remember, you can contact the show by sending an email to friendofmarilyn@aol.com. You can also check out my blog and my Tumblr, both of the same name. Friend of Marilyn will be going on a 3-week hiatus as I am traveling to Singapore to spend time with my best friend and her husband. I'll see you back in mid-November.